Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Have you been inspired by a piece of travel writing to try a similar endeavour of your own, but found circumstance or lack of courage has knocked you off your stride? Not so Nick Hunt, who as a teenager read Patrick Leigh Fermor's account of a walk across Europe. Nick has followed in Fermor's footsteps, walking from the Hook of Holland to Istanbul, recounting his seven-month journey in a book entitled Walking the Woods and the Water. What pace do you set yourself? How do you keep yourself going? Who do you have as your companions? What do you learn about yourself and about walking? As I try to keep up with Nick on a walk along the popular canal towpath from Broadway Market to Islington, I ask him these questions and more.
My name's Nick Hunt, and the book is called Walking the Woods and the Water. It's an account of a 7.5 month walk across Europe from the Hook of Holland to Istanbul. It was based on the books of Patrick Leigh Fermor, A Time of Gifts and Between the Woods and the Water. There were two books I read when I was 18, and for some reason they really haunted me. They really stuck in my mind. It was just a journey that I always dreamed of doing.
It's quite daunting to walk along beside someone who's been walking for 7.5 months. That's an extraordinary endeavour to begin with. Tell me, how much sort of planning did you have to do for it, and what sort of things did you have to do?
My idea was not to plan in great detail. Obviously, I looked at you started off with the maps that were drawn in the front of Patrick Leigh Fermor's books. I went through reading the book, circling every town and village that was mentioned, and then got a big roadmap of Europe and just did the same on that big map. And then drew a line in pencil that went basically down the Rhine, or up the Rhine, along the Danube to the Black Sea, and then down. And then started filling in the gaps in between. But I didn't look at Google Maps or any very detailed maps, because I wanted to keep it as fresh as possible when I did it. I started out, for the first month or so, I went on to Couchsurfing website.
So, you're a man who's tried Couchsurfing, and it's worked for you?
It worked very well.
And tell us, how does that, what is the function there, and what's the...
I saw it as a modern interpretation of a very old gesture of hospitality, an impulse for hospitality. Basically, people offer a spare couch or a spare bed, or a mattress or whatever they can, in return for a vague promise that you would do the same for them in the future. So people just kind of open up their house.
So you had a fair idea about when you were going to start, how long it would take you, because you had to sort of plan these couch surfing, or were you couch surfing while you went?
So I planned the first few weeks, I'd say, and then I did a bit as I went. But really, I based each day's walk more or less on what Paddy had done, my predecessor, because he'd say that he walked for a day and then stayed in this place, and that was a pretty good measure. Sometimes I did more, sometimes I did less, but I'd always look for somewhere in that vicinity that had a couch surfing person. And there's an incredible amount of them. Even in some of the smallest villages, there'll be two or three people. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, that's in Germany, Austria. As I got further east, less people were doing it.
But more people were open, perhaps, to being
they were.
With the hospitality, the gesture of having the lone walker.
Yeah, it became a lot easier and less formal the further east I got. And by that point, I was camping, so I had a tent. But I was also meeting people who would invite me in, or they would have a friend or a cousin in the next village that I could stay with. And that happened increasingly.
Okay, so you were carrying a pack, which included a tent.
Yeah.
A sleeping bag.
Sleeping bag.
And what other accoutrements or accessories were things that you started out with? And what did you jettison?
So I had few spare changes of clothes, getting more and more filthy and dishevelled. Waterproofs. I jettisoned my gaiters pretty early on. I'd kind of thought that they would be incredibly useful. I just found them a pain. They served me well in the snow, and then I got rid of them. Things I picked up, a pair of walking poles. I got an ankle injury in Germany, and the doctor recommended these things, which I'd been very sceptical of when I'd seen other people using them, but actually they really helped me.
What's the intention of the walk to sort of give you... You were trying to step inside the character of Firm, or were you trying to just discover an area of Europe you hadn't sort of kind of discovered yourself? Or, may I be so daring to suggest, as you are a writer, was it because you wanted to write something?
It definitely wasn't my intention to step inside Fermor's character. He had a very large and flamboyant character, and I think it's a dangerous one to try and imitate, so that was never my intention. But the thing I was interested in was the possibility of the journey itself. I wanted to find out if it was possible to discover the same kind of magic that he'd found. So it was really the kind of the spirit of the journey was what I was interested in, rather than him as a person. Discovering Europe was an important part of it as well. I'd travelled by that point far-flung countries, different continents, and I'd never been to Germany, I'd never been to Austria, I didn't know the continent on my doorstep. And the thought of Eastern Europe again was fascinating. So I realised it's something so close to our own culture, but so different.
You could have chosen 7.5 months when there wasn't snow, but you actually chose to set off at the snowiest time, didn't you?
The 9th of December.
And did that relate to when Paddy Fermor had done the same? I mean, was that your intention was to try to reproduce the timing as well?
Yeah. I think I reproduced as much as I could, and that was... the time of year seemed important. Yeah, I think I needed to do it that way. Otherwise, the climate and the weather are so important to the experience of walking. And I wanted to replicate his environmental conditions as much as possible.
And so there were no doubt days when you looked out and you thought, crikey, what on earth have I set myself up for now? This looks like a miserable day to walk in.
Yeah, there were several of them, but actually not so much with the snow. I found the snow quite good conditions to walk in, as long as my boots were dry. And
what were the darkest days, and what were the elements that contributed to them being dark? It wasn't necessarily the weather, it could have been robbery, or I don't know, you know, threatening vehicles or threatening youths, or you know what? What were the...
Threatening vehicles were a constant darkness on my journey. I was forced to walk alongside roads very close to busy traffic, more than I would have liked.
I mean, that's partly because you didn't plan it.
Well, it's partly I didn't look for kind of walking routes.
Yes,
all the way through.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. They're not easy to find when it's snowing, are they?
No, they're not. But actually, I mean, in terms of the weather, the snow was not the hardest. I think the hardest was constant rain. When I was my first sort of couple of weeks in Romania and Transylvania, I was just so wet. And it got to the point where nothing could dry out. My boots were permanently wet. My coat was permanently wet. My clothes smelt of damp and mould. And there were definitely some dark mornings waking up and seeing yet another day of rain and knowing that I had another kind of 7 or 8 hours just walking, soaking wet, with no possibility of getting dry that night.
Well, what do you think your most valuable possession was?
I'd say my tent. Mm-hmm. My tent liberated me. I bought it in Budapest, and up until that point, after the couch surfing tailed off, I had done a bit of sleeping out. I knew I couldn't do that all the time because of the weather. But on a dry night, it was fine. But the tent really gave me the possibility of not relying on people's charity. like it was there if they wanted to offer it.
Paddy Firmer seemed to have the a group of connections that parked him in quite grand houses. I don't suppose you had that.
He did. The grand houses were one of the biggest changes between his journey and mine. All of those aristocratic country houses and mansions have been despoiled and left derelict now. Inhabitants long gone. So no, I didn't have those connections. So the tent was kind of sleeping in the ruins of this charming culture that he'd witnessed. I think it's very important if you are taking people's hospitality not to depend on it. So I'd find there's a big difference between just kind of expecting someone to put you up and asking, can I camp in the woods up there? Can I camp in the fields by the edge of the village? And if they wanted to say, why don't you sleep in our spare room, then they could, but they didn't feel
they
like
they could offer you a shower or something like that.
They didn't feel like I was begging.
Yeah, when I did the sort of durational walk across Belgium, I think my most useful or valuable possession was an umbrella, and I took an umbrella with me because I, you know, renowned bad weather in the summers, you know, sort of heavy rain, thunderstorm type of thing. But as it was, we actually used it as a parasol more than anything. It was to keep the heat off. So I was going to ask, you know, what did you wear a hat? Did you find that it was, you know, during the summer months it was incredibly hot where you were walking? Because I think a lot of people don't realise if you set off for a whole day's walk, you're actually in the sun or you're out in the elements for a long time, aren't you?
So I had three main hats. I had a woolly hat for the winter, or one of those ones with the ear flaps and pull down and fasten under the chin. That was fantastic in the snow. I bought a one of those Bavarian wool, like Federer type hats in Munich. That served me very well because it keeps the snow off your face. I think it wasn't actually until Bulgaria that finally I admitted defeat with that hat and got a straw one because it was so hot by that point. And yeah, the heat, I think, was a lot harder than the cold in terms of walking. As long as it was dry and cold, it was actually ideal. But as soon as I got into the proper heat of summer in the south of Europe, that's when the blisters came. That's when I was permanently sweating. That's when everything, like my straps and my bag, started really chafing my shoulders. Yeah, I think that was much harder walking conditions.
And for the whole journey, did you sort of set out in your mind's eye that you were going to walk every day, or did you sort of plan, well, I'll walk for 4 days and have a long weekend off and then walk for another 4 days? You weren't actually keeping directly to his timetable once you'd started off, had you?
No, that wouldn't have made sense, because it would mean that I'd have denied offers to stay with people for longer and tried to seek them in places where there wasn't any. So I fell out of step with him fairly quickly. I think I started out with the idea of doing 5 days walking and one off, but that broke down quite quickly, especially because I got injured within 4 days and had to rest up for three.
Most of the time you were walking on your own, you weren't accompanied by anyone, or did you get friends to come and join you, or you met people and they said, oh, I'll walk with you?
It was all on my own, with the exception of a week where my girlfriend came and joined me, and we walked through the very last bit of Austria along the Danube to the border of Slovakia. And then in Bulgaria I got a follower for the first time, a woman called Veni, who I'd stayed in her house with her and her husband. And it was interesting, my turning up I think kind of rekindled some kind of buried wandering instinct that she had. She was now a mother and was married, and she said, I used to do what you do all the time. I used to go out with my friends, we used to go up to the mountains and camp and walk for a week or 2 weeks. So she came and joined me for a fairly disastrous couple of days of walking. She got terribly dehydrated, blisters all over her feet, almost collapsed a couple of times. I mean, this was in the real heat of summer.
And you suddenly felt responsible for someone.
When you're walking for that long, everything's in your control and you stop and go whenever you want. So it was quite frustrating because suddenly this was out of my control. It was also good, I think, to change pace and to have someone else with me. Eventually we got her back on a train to hitch a ride in the gypsy cart for the last a few miles to kind of get to the station because she couldn't walk.
One of the things, obviously, with couch surfing was that in your 7.5 months, you did actually stay with a lot of people you'd never met before. So you have long periods when you're walking alone, and then you have to sort of break into, or switch quite quickly into sort of, oh, I've got to be jolly and sort of friendly, and probably recount the tale of what you've just done to someone you don't know, and basically build that kind of conviviality and trust really quickly. So were there any horrors, and were there any really special friendships?
There were lots of special friendships. There were not so many horrors. Generally, the kind of people that offer hospitality to someone walking for 7 months with a backpack, kind of on the same level in some way, but all different ages, all different backgrounds, people that I stayed with. And it was quite hard after a day of walking just with myself for company, suddenly to switch into this other mode. Obviously recounting the story, explaining why I was doing it, but the background to the walk, that always took a bit of time. I got very good at summarising what I was doing.
If you can think back over the 7.5 months, which was your dish of the, your meal that you'd most remember, because I think that too is the case, is that in the book you talk about meeting so many people and sitting down and having a meal with them. So you've eaten lots of home-cooked food.
Well, I know the one that really stands out was having crossed the hardest part was over the Carpathian Mountains in the south of Romania, and I'd climbed for 3 days through snow and ice, kind of quite unprepared for that, and really just kind of, it was like entering another world. I was the only person that I saw, just a land of glacial lakes and great crevasses and moraines. And then I'd got lost in the fog for another day after that, just to the point where I thought I'd be starting to come off the mountain. I got completely lost in the fog and the snow. I was soaked through. All my food had gone. What had seemed sensible rations had been completely depleted. And at the point when I really needed some food and shelter, and just kind of the comfort of knowing that I was kind of safe again, I made my way down to what was marked on the map as a hunting house. I didn't really know what that was, but it kind of got me off the mountain. I got to this hut, and inside were an old couple, old Romanian couple, who worked as foresters. And they sat me down and they prepared a meal of fried eggs, sausage, something called slanina, which is a cured pig's fat. It's like white lumps of fat that I'd actually become quite partial to in this time, because it was kind of fat and energy. And he made tea out of plants he collected on the mountain. He gave me a shot of kind of fire water, of mint again that he'd collected, and slices of thick bread. And I remember that meal was kind of so good it almost made me cry. Just the fact that this was being offered to me, and these very open-hearted people with whom I couldn't communicate at all, had no language in common.
Coming up to that, you had points at which you sort of had a fear of being lost. I mean, I remember early on in the book you talk about walking through snow, and because, you know, the landscape suddenly gets sort of flat and softened, and it's difficult to see landmarks and things like that. Were there times when you felt, you know, shit, I've rather gone beyond where I want to be? I've kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, there were those moments of when I kind of talk about this quite a lot in the book, where it's a desire for wilderness, a desire to get lost and to really go beyond the ordinary landscape that you're used to. But then there was always a moment of genuine fear, which I thought was very interesting, because it felt like kind of flirting with this idea of proper wilderness. But actually, when you sense what that might be like, it's scary. I mean, especially in the Carpathians, when I realised that if something happened to me, that was really on my own. You know, there was no one about. I didn't have any equipment, no way of contacting people. No one knew where I was. But also, that happened in supposedly much safer environments sometimes as well, like in patches of woodland in Austria. when I was away from paths, it was covered in snow, evening was coming. I didn't know quite where I was, and just had to trust that if I kept going in the same direction, I would get out of the wood before dark and I would find somewhere to sleep. Yeah, this was a kind of a recurring theme. And when I came back into civilization and safety, I was always aware of something that was something between relief and disappointment.
You've written a book, but while you were actually walking, were you sort of scratching notes in a notebook, or were you doing a sort of diary journal at the end of each day? And you know, were you typing it up and blogging it simultaneously? What was your process for writing?
It was scribbling in notebooks, increasingly obsessively. So yeah, I was writing in these notebooks, and often stopping kind of every 5 minutes, seemingly, to scribble something down. Nothing seemed beyond interest for most of the journey, and that was one of the hard things, was coming back and looking at what I had and editing, and realizing that, you know, the funny looking dog I'd seen on a certain day wasn't really that interesting after 6 months later. And I also recorded a lot of it with sound. I had a recorder a bit like yours. For every day I tried to record about 30 seconds or a minute of something that seemed to represent that day's journey. There might have been church bells, people singing around a campfire, or people talking in a pub, or dogs barking, or traffic, or the sound of rain falling on leaves. I edited all of this down into about 45 minutes. It's a 45-minute track of ambient sound from the journey.
7.5 months of ambient sound.
Yeah, just, wow. Just squeezed into one.
That's challenging enough. Here we are, we're gently walking along beside the Regent's Canal. Was this the kind of pace you went at, or are we going more slowly then?
No, I went faster than this.
Yeah.
I tend to walk pretty quickly. I think everyone has a sort of natural walking pace.
Yeah.
So I'd kind of be walking maybe this sort of pace.
He's leaving me behind. Yeah. Can you give us a sort of 8 landmarks that people should know when they next look at Europe, that you've, where you've walked, the route that it was?
I'll try and do this in 8 sections. They're not exactly landmarks, but just to give a shape, overall shape for the journey. So across the Netherlands into Germany, that's pretty easy, pretty flat and straight. Up the Rhine, across the hills of Baden into Bavaria, and then basically along the Danube, right the way to Vienna and Bratislava beyond. And then follow the Danube down to Budapest, and then over the Great Hungarian Plain, which is like a desert, kind of one of the Eurasian steppes, the westernmost Eurasian steppe, into the green heartland of Romania, over the Carpathian Mountains, over the mountains of Bulgaria to the Black Sea coast, and then from the Black Sea coast, keep the sea to your left and head south. It's a quick way of finding Istanbul.
Is there a section of the route that you'd say to people, you know, if you're ever in Austria, I really recommend this, or if you're ever in Greece, or whatever, is there a section of the route you'd like to recommend?
One of the most beautiful sections was the Wachau Valley in Austria, along the Danube. And it's the part where it gets really wild, and there's pine forests on each side, these amazing ruined spires and turrets sticking out of the woods. When I went, it was in the depths of winter, and the Danube was part frozen, and you get these amazing sounds of the ice kind of drifting and squeaking as it negotiated its way around itself in the woods. It was really like, you know, you wouldn't really believe you were in the middle of Europe, really. Just deep snow, deep pine forest, deep silence. The Carpathian Mountains in Romania. That was, again, another point where I really felt like I'd left the ordinary world behind. Just like being elevated to another, kind of another reality. Yeah, those are two sections that really I will always remember as being very special.
Is there a city that you walked into, and the walking into was something that you'd like to recommend to people?
Budapest. I'd come in from the Pilis Hills, which were a few days of complete solitude in these beech forests and wooded hills. And the few sort of high points in Hungary, topographically. But then coming into Budapest, I had that amazing approach as you go down the Danube, and suddenly bridges appear, and these amazing spires and turrets, and then the Hill of Buddha with the Coronation Church and these amazing kind of whimsical white stone follies. And it really felt like kind of walking into from a distance, a fairy tale city, and up close, this wonderful, seedy, crumbling grandeur. And I found myself in the heart of the city amazingly quickly, from kind of seemingly being in the forest to suddenly being in the centre of Budapest.
I often talk to people about when I walked across Belgium, mm-hmm. and we took sort of 16 full days of walking and a few others besides to travel 370 kilometres. And when you kind of work that out, that's about 20k a day.
Mm-hmm.
But that was only for a month. Now, you did this for 7.5 months. So how did you develop your pace? How did you get into your stride? How did you learn to walk that kind of distance?
Probably the first 2 or 3 weeks to a month was deeply... I found it deeply frustrating how slowly I was going. I had this great map spread in front of me, this sense of months and months and months ahead, and I was walking through Holland and Germany the snail's pace, even though I knew that that's why I was doing it. I knew I wanted to walk. I knew the whole point of it was to travel slowly. I knew I was in no hurry at all. It took me a long time to actually internalize that, to appreciate the act of walking for its own sake, and not just as a means of travel, but as a kind of meditation in itself. By the end, you know, I'd got quite addicted to walking as a activity. I felt good when I walked. Often if I had been laid up somewhere, or even sedentary somewhere that I really loved, there'd always be this itch to carry
to get
on.
Out.
Yeah, because it's a very addictive thing to do somehow. Maybe it's the endorphins, or just this constant slow movement of things and a slow progression.
From my own experience, and as I say, this sort of long distance walking isn't really in my bag, but it is very much observing things and realizing the richness of what's around you, which previously, if you were traveling by any other mode, apart from a bit of cycling, you actually miss out on.
Yeah.
So there's so much more to absorb.
Yeah, there is. And you see things that you would never see, even cycling. I mean, there's an amazing difference between, say, you're in an ugly landscape in some kind of grey, drizzly suburbs. On a bike, still, you zip out of that within minutes, but walking, you're really stuck with it. You can't get away from it. So I came to appreciate that process, the way that walking exposes you to everything. And that could be angry dogs, it could be cars, it's frequently bad weather, but it's also people's kindness and these chance encounters that you simply wouldn't have access to going at any other pace.
What's the next big project or?
I'm planning to walk somewhere. I haven't quite found the hook yet. There needs to be something that links me to it, but I would love to return to the Balkans. I'd love to go back to Eastern Europe. I don't know quite what it'll be, but it will involve walking, because I think it's a very good way of travelling and learning about a place.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities in London. In this episode, you've heard from Nick Hunt, author of Walking the Woods and the Water. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stark of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.